The Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall is turning up the heat this summer. Buy now with no down payment and no payments for 120 days.
That means no payments until fall. No payments until fall.
With over 8,000 cars, trucks, and SUVs available, there's something for every budget and lifestyle. Pick your ride, get approved, and drive home today with nothing due until autumn.
But hurry, these offers won't last forever.
Visit Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall and take advantage while selection is strong.
Lowe's knows how to help you save. This July 4th, get up to 40% off select Maytag laundry appliances. Plus, get an additional 10% off when you buy two or three select major appliances. And when you buy four or more, you'll save an additional 20%. Find the right appliances and features that fit your home's unique needs and style. Shop Maytag 4th of July deals at Lowe's. Valid through 7/9. See Lowe's.com for details. Savings vary based on purchase amount. Selection varies by location.
Welcome, everyone, to the Mona Charon podcast. I'm really delighted this week to welcome Professor Stephen Vladeck. He's a professor at Georgetown Law School. The Trump administration has come in with a blizzard of executive orders. And in order to get the big picture and to actually understand at a deeper level both the threats to the rule of law, but also the legal basis for some of these things, I thought maybe we could dig into that. So, first of all, thank you so much for joining me.
Thanks for having me.
Second, let's go to this whole concept of executive orders, okay? A lot of people don't know, where does executive order power come from? I mean, you know, Justice Thomas is always asking at oral arguments, you know, by what authority? And, you know, it's worth asking, certainly in this case, where they are asserting this sweeping power. Well, Trump believes he can do just about anything. But let's talk about the history of executive orders.
Sure. So, you know, the Constitution gives the president in Article 2 the power, indeed the obligation, to, quote, take care that the laws be faithfully executed. And, you know, Mona, going back pretty close to the founding, presidents have interpreted that provision as basically a invitation, if not a requirement, that the presidents have their own views of the law, that when Congress passes statutes or when acting based on constitutional provisions, it is both necessary and appropriate for presidents to articulate what they believe the law allows, what they believe the law requires. So, you know, in the abstract, executive orders are not per se controversial. Rather, they really are meant to be organizational documents, informational documents, communications to the public and the relevant agencies and constituents about what the president believes the law requires. I think part of what has become especially controversial in recent years, no matter what your politics are, is that presidents have used executive orders more and more aggressively, not just to clarify ambiguities, Mona, but actually to claim power in spaces where they haven't previously, or to assert that statutes mean something other than they've been interpreted to mean, or to make other arguments that are disrupting what had been settled legal understandings and claim the power to do so through executive orders. So it's not the order itself that's the problem. It's sort of exactly what it's being used for.
Executive orders have been used for some very good reasons and some not so good reasons in American history. So they were used, correct me if I'm wrong, to desegregate the armed forces, for example. They were used by Lyndon Johnson. Actually, we can get to that because Trump has just revoked it, but to forbid forbid discrimination in hiring by the federal government or contractors with the federal government on the basis of race, creed, national origin, and so forth. They've also been used to put Japanese American citizens in internment camps and for other things that weren't so great. So there was a big case, and let's talk about this, where the whole scope of the president's power got debated. Youngstown Sheet and Steel. And this was the case where Harry Truman, President Harry Truman, wanted to basically take over the steel mills in the United States. And this was at a time of war. We were in the Korean War at the time. And even still, the Supreme Court ruled that he didn't have the power, even as commander in chief.
That's right. And what is, I think, striking about Youngstown is that the six justices in the majority, although they differed as to exactly why they thought Truman should lose, they all started from the same basic proposition, which is that the president can only act if either a statute or the Constitution authorizes him to act. And in the context of the steel seizure, there was no statute. And the six justices in the majority didn't think that the Constitution allowed the president to act, Mona, inherently. And, you know, we have other examples of cases like that. I mean, I think the, you know, the reality of the internment camps in the companion case to Korematsu, a case most folks don't know about called Ex Parte Endo. The Supreme Court held actually that the detention of a admittedly loyal 14-year-old Japanese-American girl was unauthorized by statute. So, you know, there's a long history of the courts not just taking the president's word for it when he claims power to act through executive orders, but rather scrutinizing those orders carefully to see if they actually do comport with the relevant statutory and constitutional underpinnings.
So you talked earlier about presidents asserting basically by executive order what the law is. So how would you evaluate President Obama's decision to remove the employer mandate, for example, from the ACA by executive action? That was not in the legislation. Was he acting outside his authority?
So I think that one goes right up to the line. It goes up to a line, Mona, that I think folks have debated for decades, which is to what extent do presidents have the right to decline to enforce particular provisions of statutes. And so, you know, presidents going back to at least FDR have claimed the power to not enforce statutes, whether for constitutional reasons or policy reasons. And I think the Obama example, you know, my own view is that I think it probably crossed over the line, but it at least had some precedent to stand on. You know, there's a whole history of the Justice Department sort of articulating criteria for when presidents can decline to enforce statutes. And I think it's worth stressing, declining to enforce a statute is a subject all unto itself. That's different, right, from claiming that a statute allows you to take actions no president has ever taken before, or claiming that a statute that has been upheld for decades is actually unconstitutional, or claiming that a statute means something completely different than we had thought. And so in the space of executive orders across different presidencies, Republicans and Democrats alike, we get, Mona, different flashpoints for what presidents can do legally and what they can't do legally. And it's really, you know, it's hard to generalize beyond saying it's more than a matter of just the president saying so.
In his first term, Trump did say that he thought Article 2 gave him the power to do whatever he wants. That was his constitutional exegesis there. But before we leave the topic of history, I just wanted, I have a memory that it wasn't that long ago that the court made a statement about Korematsu, the decision that at the time had upheld the internment of Japanese Americans, saying it was effectively overruled or it's something along those lines, but they didn't explicitly overrule it. Does that have any relevance for the debates we're having right now?
Maybe atmospherically, but I don't think sort of in any direct way. So it was in the travel ban case in 2018 in Trump versus Hawaii, where, you know, Chief Justice Roberts' majority opinion said that Korematsu has been overruled in the court of history, whatever that means. Yeah. You know, I think to be very specific and perhaps too specific for a second, you know, in Korematsu itself, all that the Supreme Court did was uphold a statute that made it a crime to violate one of the nefarious exclusion orders right, that if you voluntarily complied with the exclusion orders, you couldn't be prosecuted. And I think the shameful thing the Supreme Court had done in Korematsu was to uphold that statute. Mona, there are now statutory protections in place that would prevent, at least for citizens, anything like the Japanese American internment camps from recurring. Congress in 1971 passed a statute that requires specific statutory authorization before any American citizens can be detained. And so I think, you know, we've already seen from the flurry of executive orders this week, I think the more nefarious, the more controversial actions that have the sort of Korematsu flavor to them are going to come on the non-citizen side, on the immigration side. And that Korematsu, whether or not it's been overruled by the Supreme Court formally, is not capable of recurring under our current law.
Okay, so let's talk for a few minutes about the things that Trump is doing that are within the mandate of the president and not even arguably unconstitutional. For example, it's fine for him to, not as a matter of policy, but as a matter of law, isn't it just fine for him to, for example, revoke Lyndon Johnson's executive order forbidding discrimination in federal contracting?
The Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall is turning up the heat this summer. Buy now with no down payment and no payments for 120 days.
That means no payments until fall. No payments until fall.
With over 8,000 cars, trucks, and SUVs available, there's something for every budget and lifestyle. Pick your ride, get approved, and drive home today with nothing due until autumn. But hurry, these offers won't last forever. Visit Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall and take advantage while selection is strong.
Yeah, so, I mean, usually, and there are a few very, very weird and nerdy counterexamples, but usually, yeah, just as a president can issue an executive order, a future president can revoke an executive order. It would be weird if a president at time one could entrench an executive order at time two, right? Things get tricky if and when those executive orders have created reliance interests, but, you know, this is not one of those. Mona, I would add to the list of perfectly lawful, regardless of policy, President Trump's executive order with regard to granting security clearances on an interim basis to a bunch of folks who maybe you or I might not choose to grant security clearances to. You know, for better or worse, the president can give security clearances even to people who probably shouldn't have them. Revoking security clearances is a little trickier because there are some, you know, statutes that exist in that space that require at least a little bit of process to be followed. But, you know, Mona, restructuring the executive branch, right? Creating or repurposing an office in the White House to become this DOGE entity.
DOGE.
Right. You know, we might think it's kind of silly, if not a waste of government resources, but the president gets to do that. And, you know, so I think it's important to be precise, right, about what the president is doing that is maybe unwise, right, versus where I think he is already brushing up against, if not crossing, some pretty firm legal lines.
Yeah. So I guess I would throw, maybe I'd love to hear your views. I would throw in, you know, reversing this EV mandate or whatever that Biden had enacted that he can reverse. And then, unfortunately, because the Congress... Hey, by the way, before we talk about Congress giving power to the president.
Congress.
I'm curious about your view on this. You hear constantly people saying we have three co-equal branches of government. Where do you stand on that? I know a lot of smart people say, wait a minute, it's not supposed to be three co-equal branches. Congress is supposed to be first and most important.
Whether Congress is supposed to dominate or just be co-equal, Mona, the current place is neither.
well, that's true.
but I think it's an important point. I mean, part of why presidents of both parties have increasingly felt the need to govern through executive orders and to govern through regulations is because, you know, for the better part of a generation, Congress has stopped doing its job. And, you know, there are reasons why that's happened. I'm not a political scientist. You know, I think there are people who are much smarter about that than I am. But we're seeing the consequences, which is, you know, more and more government by executive action, where as opposed to trying to figure out, you know, do we support what the majority in Congress did versus not what the majority in Congress did? Now it's just, do we support this guy or not? And I think that really heightens the partisan valence of federal policies that not so long ago might not have all divided us into our camps, right? And so I think that raises the stakes.
Yeah. And it makes every presidential election like life or death from the point of view of partisans, right? Because instead, like the founders established a system, you know, Congress people would be elected every 2 years and presidents for four and senators for six. And the idea being you'd have some stability at every stage and you wouldn't have these wild swings. Depending on who won. But if the Congress is completely, surrendering its authority, then it really does raise the stakes for every presidential election.
And for the courts, because the more that Congress is ceding the field, the more that we're left to these sort of, you know, executive judicial confrontations, where even a Supreme Court that might be sympathetic to an incumbent president is going to feel lots of institutional pressure to push back simply to try to preserve the separation of powers.
Which we will come to. I'm curious as to whether you think how you think that will go. All right, let's spend a few minutes though on tariff power, because here I don't think it's I don't think it's controversial. I mean, the fact is Congress did give the president huge amounts of latitude about imposing tariffs. But there's one question I have for you, which is a lot of these pieces of legislation talk about the president will have power to impose tariffs in cases of like war or in cases
or national
of
emergency.
National emergency. Yep. And so when the president says it's a national emergency that we're being invaded by immigrants and therefore I need to impose tariffs, I mean, last time around, he got away with this argument. I don't know if it was a challenge, but he got away with this argument about imposing
steel tariffs.
On Canada.
Yep. You
know? I mean, yep. And so my question for you is there any sort of laugh test about, what you could reasonably call a national emergency or no?
I think rhetorically there is. I think legally it's trickier. So the steel tariffs are a great example. And it gets back to the problem we were discussing, which is Congress either not doing anything or delegating way too much power to the president. So in the steel tariffs example, you had this open-ended statute that says if the president declares a national emergency, blah, blah. This was challenged. And it was upheld by the federal circuit, the weird federal appeals court that handles certain kinds of suits against the federal government. But it never went to the Supreme Court. And so there's at least the possibility that that question is open. Indeed, in the context of the border wall, where President Trump had also declared what was just absolutely a sham national emergency for no other purpose than to free up access to military construction funds, lower courts ruled against him. And so, you know, I think in contrast to birthright citizenship, where I think the law is clearly against what Trump is doing, I think on the sort of national emergency tariff side, the law is not clearly against it, but also the Supreme Court hasn't settled the matter. So if he goes that route, when he goes that route, I think, you know, that could very well be a viable legal challenge, at least in the Supreme Court, if not in the lower courts.
So they could reasonably say, look, Your Honors, there's no emergency here.
Right. I mean, maybe the answer is like the president's entitled to significant deference when it comes to declaring an emergency, but not absolute categorical deference.
Rule that that agencies are not entitled to deference? So, you know, maybe there's relevance to this.
I mean, so it's an interesting split, Mona. I mean, I think there is a divide, especially among some of the conservative justices, about deference to agencies versus deference to national security assertions by the president. And I think we just saw some of that in the TikTok case, where the court and, you know, and I think you can find this almost overtly in Justice Kavanaugh's writings, that, you know, Justice Kavanaugh is hostile to agency deference, but actually is very sympathetic to presidential deference. You know, you could, I think, defend that on theoretical grounds. I guess when push comes to shove, if there really is a tariffs case in the Supreme Court, I wonder if there might be some wiggle room if it's so clear that the proclaimed emergency was simply a pretext, right, to be able to activate this standby authority.
So Trump has declared a couple of emergencies already within the first week. And, you know, it does sound like what happens. I'm not saying we are equivalent, but it's what you see in countries like Venezuela and Russia and the Philippines under Marcos and other situations where autocratic leaders come in order to seize power, they declare emergencies.
Yeah, I mean, so if I can be slightly less of a doomsayer for the
please.
So
the Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall is turning up the heat this summer. Buy now with no down payment and no payments for 120 days.
That means no payments until fall. No payments until fall.
With over 8,000 cars, trucks, and SUVs available, there's something for every budget and lifestyle. Pick your ride, get approved, and drive home today with nothing due until autumn. But hurry, these offers won't last forever. Visit Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall and take advantage while selection is strong.
Declaring an emergency under our law doesn't open the floodgates to the kinds of powers, the kinds of dictatorial powers that we've seen in other countries.
Right.
It does trigger a whole bunch of statutory authorities that are important and that are significant. You just mentioned tariffs, right? There are other economic authorities. There are a handful of public health and immigration authorities that depend upon the declaration of a national emergency. And those are, you know, it's problematic to me as a policy matter that the president can do that. In some sense, Mona, the terminology is misleading because it's not that it's an emergency. It's that I've declared a case of, you know, argle bargle. And when it's argle bargle, I get to do these things. Right.
Yeah.
It's not that there's no constitutional or statutory provision that gives the president just general authority to do whatever he wants in an emergency. And so we should be wary of these declarations, but we shouldn't be sort of overreacting to them either. Plenty of presidents of both parties have declared national emergencies that I suspect you or I would look at and say, really? Right. But to go back to the theme here, a lot of this, again, is Congress's fault. Right. So Congress, when it wrote the National Emergencies Act in 1976, it actually tried to clean this up. And it provided that national emergencies would not only sunset after a year, but that either chamber of Congress could terminate a national emergency while it was pending. Right. And what's striking is that provision was called into question by the Supreme Court's 1983 decision in INS versus Chadha, where the court said those kinds of legislative vetoes are unconstitutional. So, Mona, after Chadha, Congress amended the National Emergencies Act and just took that all out. So as opposed to putting in additional different constraints, right? Congress's reaction was, fine, we'll just give up.
Exactly.
And that's part of how we got to where we are.
Yeah. Okay. So let's talk, though, about the area. So we talked about areas where he has been given the authority, the presidency has, and it's pretty clear. But then let's talk about areas where it's not so clear. So birthright citizenship. You can tell us the history, as I understand it, is pretty, you know, the court is now deciding things on text, history, and tradition. It seems like the history, the text, the history, and the tradition all seem to point in one direction here.
True. Just to be clear, right, this is a fight over the meaning of the Citizenship Clause of the 14th Amendment, which was ratified in 1868. And which guarantees birthright citizenship to anyone, you know, born in the United States and, quote, subject to the jurisdiction thereof, unquote. The argument that is being advanced in support of President Trump's efforts to limit birthright citizenship are that undocumented immigrants are not, quote, subject to the jurisdiction thereof, unquote. First of all, that's not what the executive order says. It actually is much broader than undocumented immigrants. It includes lots of folks born to visa holders. If those visas
legal
are temporary.
Residents. Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah.
Now that might just be a litigating position, so that the the lesser version somehow looks better. But Mona, second, if undocumented immigrants were not subject to the jurisdiction thereof, we couldn't prosecute them.
Right.
I mean the notion that we're going to somehow say yes, they're here for purposes of our criminal laws and for purposes of our sort of civil tax laws and for everything else, but they're not here for, you can't split that difference.
Right.
And so this is why I think.
Let me just interrupt to put a draw a line under that. So
yeah.
Subject to the jurisdiction thereof means. They can be arrested. They can be fined. They can be, deported. There are all kinds of things that we can do to them because they are under our jurisdiction, as opposed to people like at the time, members of Indian tribes and children of diplomats who were not under our jurisdiction.
Right. We can't prosecute the, British ambassador to the United States, right? We can,
right.
We can PNG him. We can say, right. You're persona non grata.
And you gotta leave. Right.
Right, but that's it. It's remarkable just how self-defeating this argument actually is, and it's going to lose. I mean, this
Wong Kim Ark, the 1898 case.
Yeah, so the Supreme Court had this issue. I mean, not exactly in this form. So Wong Kim Ark is the 1898 case where the Supreme Court adopted this very reading of the Citizenship Clause of the 14th Amendment. Now Wong Kim Ark's parents. Were neither legal nor illegal, right? They entered the United States at a time when we didn't really have the kinds of contemporary immigration restrictions that we have. But the court's opinion was emphatic that the exceptions to birthright citizenship are very narrow, right? You mentioned, certain Native Americans, not all, right? Children of foreign diplomats. And the only other example that the court referred to were children born during forces engaged in hostile occupation. you hear talk from the folks who support this about invasion and how we're under invasion at the southern border. That's obviously nuts. But even if you thought there was merit to the invasion argument, the Wong Kim Ark doesn't say invasion. It says hostile occupation. Last I checked, we are not being hostily occupied by anybody.
Yeah. Okay. So, based on your study of the current Supreme Court, do you think it would be a very decisive win for the traditional interpretation of the 14th Amendment?
I do. I mean, I should put in one caveat, which is that the way this issue is going to reach the Supreme Court could complicate that a bit, because chances are the policy is going to be subject to a nationwide injunction. Indeed, there's a hearing going on as we are recording this. There's the first hearing in one of the cases challenging this policy. And then it'll reach the Supreme Court first, presumably through an application from Trump's Justice Department. For a stay, right, for some kind of emergency ruling, putting the policy back into effect. I'm slightly less, I think, confident that the court will sort of deny the stay, although I think it probably will. But on the merits, I mean, Mona, I just don't see, even four votes for the Trump administration's position. And frankly, I have a hard time counting the three. I could see Justice Alito being sympathetic maybe to some of this position. Maybe Justice Thomas, but man, I mean, this is not one of those areas where historically liberals and conservatives have disagreed, right? This is an interpretation that has been one of those few examples of a policy area where there's been widespread cross-spectrum agreement on what the Constitution means.
Let's talk about TikTok. So... It has only been a week or so since the Supreme Court said, yep, Congress can do this, national security, force TikTok to divest itself of the Chinese ownership and get an American, whatever, details in the legislation signed by the then President Biden. And Trump just asserted that he was giving a, I think a 70-day or a 90-day reprieve from the fines that would otherwise attach to companies that hosted TikTok until he can work something out. This, tell me if I'm wrong, this strikes me as completely lawless. And everybody just sort of nodded and said, oh, yeah, okay. If Trump says that, then I guess that's okay.
So I think it is completely lawless. I will say I think the completely lawless part is actually not the 75-day pause. Right? We talked before about the sort of the running debate over the president's ability to decline to enforce certain statutes. Right. And, you know, I think this probably crosses that line, but not in a way that's as obvious to me as, for example, birthright citizenship. But Mona, there's another provision in the TikTok executive order that hasn't gotten the same attention. So Section 2C of that order instructs the Attorney General, quote, to issue a letter to each provider stating that there has been no violation of the statute and that there's no liability for any conduct that occurred during that 75-day period, as well as for any conduct between the effective date of the act and the issuance of the executive order. So note the difference, right? The provision you mentioned is, hey, we're not going to enforce this for 75 days, right? The provision I quoted is, hey, Attorney General, I want you to tell, to give this get out of liability free letter to all these companies that says what we're doing isn't illegal, even though it quite clearly is.
And what
I'm struck by that is here you have the president telling the attorney general, one, what the answer to a legal question is, two, in a case in which it clearly is not correct, right? And three, ordering the attorney general to act based upon that clearly incorrect interpretation. If I were the attorney general, right, I would not work for a president who ordered me to do these things. And yet, you know, I suspect we are going to see the confirmation of Attorney General Bondi and that, you know, she's not going to have any problem with this.
The Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall is turning up the heat this summer. Buy now with no down payment and no payments for 120 days.
That means no payments until fall. No payments until fall.
With over 8,000 cars, trucks, and SUVs available, there's something for every budget and lifestyle. Pick your ride, get approved, and drive home today with nothing due until autumn. But hurry, these offers won't last forever. Visit Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall and take advantage while selection is strong.
So where does that leave us, though? So it leaves us in a world where, you know, the top law enforcement officer of the country and the president are willing to make up a new reality and say the law means X when it clearly says Y. And then what happens? Somebody challenges it. Somebody has standing. Somebody challenges it.
And we end up in the courts. And so I think the all roads, Mona, lead to a very, very serious and heavy flurry of judicial activity where, you know, I can't predict what the courts are going to do in all of these cases. But I will say, and I say this as someone who is a very vocal critic of the current Supreme Court, like I actually have a fair amount of faith that there are at least five or six justices who are going to have problems with lots of this. Not all of it. I mean, I think, you know, the court is going to uphold more than I would. But Trump is going to lose a bunch of these cases. And to me, you know, the sort of the stuff about the attorney general, Mona, means and he'll have a Justice Department with less credibility in the Supreme Court, which is something that he's going to miss when it's gone. And I think that the question to me is, in a world in which Trump loses some pretty big cases in the Supreme Court, does he just accept it? Or do we actually see, right, some effort on his part to resist Supreme Court decisions that go against him, to defy the court? And I think that's where we would, you know, we would really get to me into a constitutional crisis.
Yes. Well, that was going to be the next thing I was going to ask you about. He seems, you can't know, but so in his first term, the one really awful thing that he did not do was defy the courts. Mm-hmm. He obeyed court orders, and he didn't attempt to discredit them too much. I mean, you know, he did say You know, it's a Mexican judge, that kind of thing. Or he would always say the judges were anti-Trump or they hated Trump. But okay. But he did abide by them. And since the Congress is gone as a check, right? And the only check on his power in theory at this point is, well, not the only, but the main check on his power is the courts. If he simply defies the Supreme Court, as J.D. Vance has recommended that he do, you know, what do you see happening? How do you think the legal profession, the legal world would react? How do you think the country would react? Where would we be?
I wish I knew. Yeah. I wish I knew. I would like to have faith that Trump defying a Supreme Court decision would finally provoke, Republicans in Congress, at least not all, but you know, a sufficient number of Republicans in Congress. So, you know, enough senators and a handful of members of the House, and perhaps lawyers within his own administration to, you know, turn their backs on him. I would like to think that that would be the Rubicon, because Mona, if he crosses that Rubicon and that's not the reaction, right? If we don't see pushback from within his own party, if we don't see pushback from Congress, if Trump defies the court and gets away with it, then that's when I think we are in truly, truly deep peril. And not this week when Trump is claiming a whole bunch of powers that have not yet been vetted, right? Like this week is exasperating and exhausting. But at least until and unless we get to that point, right, the system is still at least for the moment holding.
I have to say that the decision in the immunity case was like a gut punch for me. Mm-hmm. It really shook my confidence in this court. The way they handled it and the fact that they were willing to engage in the kind of reasoning where, you know, exactly the sort of reasoning that they had been so critical of in the past, you know, about the courts legislating from the bench and creating law out of penumbras and emanations of the, you know, and so forth. That's what they did in creating this, you know, three-tier test for presidential immunity. And to do it in the face of Trump returning to power, it really shook me because I thought it was a terrible, terrible decision and completely inconsistent with the philosophy, for example, of John Roberts, who I've always respected. And so I, with that in the background, I'm really worried that this court is going to, they're going to say that they're keeping their powder dry for when they really need to show their authority, right? And yet they keep keeping that powder dry and they never light it, right? And so then we're really in a lawless, or we're in an autocracy.
I mean, I think that's the right concern. I think I have slightly more faith than you're expressing, because I think we can point to a few counterexamples, right? So, you know, the court didn't lift a finger to help Trump during the post-2020 election cycle when they had numerous opportunities to do so. We've seen in a couple of cases, Chief Justice Roberts and Justice Barrett join the Democratic appointees in what I would call sort of rule of law implicating types of disputes. For example, in not blocking Trump's sentencing in the New York hush money case, right? You know, I think it's closer than it should be. I think the court has done no wonders for its credibility in the last few years, including but not limited to the immunity decision. But Mona, maybe it's because it helps me sleep at night. I still think that there are 5 votes on this court for the rule of law, not necessarily as I understand it, but as they do. And for pushing back against Trump if and when they think he's gone too far. And, you know, for better or for worse, I think we're going to learn a lot soon about you know, whether that's right.
All right. I think that's a very good note to end on. Thank you so much, Steve Vladeck, for joining me. And I hope we can have you back when we have more to chew over.
It's great to be with you. I hope next time it's a little happier.
Yeah, I hope so too.
The Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall is turning up the heat this summer. Buy now with no down payment and no payments for 120 days.
That means no payments until fall. No payments until fall.
With over 8,000 cars, trucks, and SUVs available, there's something for every budget and lifestyle. Pick your ride, get approved, and drive home today with nothing due until autumn. But hurry, these offers won't last forever. Visit Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall and take advantage while selection is strong.